Né?
Ah. Little fairness. But you have this, yeah, perfect. You want to keep it inside or download
Downloading is fine.
it?
And that way you can have the local copy
Yeah, I
to
will.
upload.
Doesn't it make any difference? Showing at still not showing. Not sure about two of them. Oh, yeah,
There we go.
something's happening. Okay, so you just present it. We
Yep,
need
that's
a
perfect. Yep.
okay.
All right. So I'm going to go to Dr. Hervé, and then I'll sit down and try to place the canvas. I also can't open space prices. I don't know if that's the case, but yeah, that's awesome. How do you offer?
It's a new one, so we'll make sure it's uploaded for you guys. Yep.
Yeah, so in 5 minutes, you should be able to download the file on the website.
Right, guys. So we've talked a little bit about severe weather ingredients before, so but we're going to do a bit of a deeper dive into a couple of them. So remember our four instability. Lift, moisture, and vertical shear. So we're really just going to focus on the moisture return cycle, lift, and instability processes that generate stuff that we can use for convection. So we'll go over specifically vertical wind shear later this year. I believe Andrew's giving that lecture, but we're just going to talk about these right now. So we've kind of talked a little bit about lapse rates and their contributions to instability a bit with the lapse rate tendency equation, but we haven't really talked about where they come from and how they get where they're going. So we're going to talk a little bit about the elevated mix layer. So have you guys heard that term before? Okay, I see some heads nodding. So for those who have not, really all an elevated mix layer is a layer of steeper lapse rates. And the way we generate that is by deep mixing over the Rockies and the Sierra Madres. So basically, the higher terrain across the Western US. There are actually a couple other spots in the world that generate deep elevated mixed layers. Does anybody know any off the top of their heads? No? No? A couple are the Tibetan High Plateau. So obviously, anywhere you have high elevations and strong solar heating, you're going to be able to generate lapse rates. So that's important for places like Bangladesh and southern India, where you have really similar conditions. And you can also generate steep lapse rates in parts of central Australia. It's not quite the same elevation difference, but you have a large desert inside the continent there, and you can advect a lot of those warm, dry layers further east where they have moisture. And we'll talk about why that's important here. But the main mechanism for EML generation is strong solar heating and cooler temperatures aloft. So you result in deep, dry adiabatic layers. We advect that eastward, and I'll show a graphic here next that shows why that's important. And then that develops over top of warm, moist layers. So you end up with differential advection. So here's just a map of the US based on terrain height. And so you see at A, we've got areas of higher elevation. So a lot of times that's 2,000-3,000 meters above sea level. When you take that further east, which is our prevailing wind with the southwesterly flow aloft towards A prime, you're down much closer to around 900 to, you know, below 1,000 meters above mean sea level. So you end up with a differential advection type regime. And you can see that on the cross section to the left there from A to A prime, where you're sloping your terrain down, but your flow is mostly perpendicular to that. So you're basically transporting those deep, well-mixed boundary layers further east where the ground is falling out below it, and you have the chance for differential advection. So what does this look like? Here is a couple of SKU-Ts, and we'll walk through exactly what these are because this is a little bit confusing, but the purple are underlays. So those are previous SKU-Ts. And the one on the top left here, that is the Albuquerque sounding, the 0Z sounding from May 3rd of 1999. So this is leading up to the May 3rd, 1999 significant tornado outbreak here in Oklahoma. So it's a little bit hard to see because we have the 12Z Amarillo sounding from 12 hours later overlaid over top of that. That's in the red and green. But the purples there from Albuquerque, you can see that deep, dry mixed layer. So it goes up to about 550 or so millibars. So essentially 3 to 4 kilometers. And remember, Albuquerque is quite a bit higher than even Amarillo. So they're above 850 millibars there. They're extremely dry. It's a desert. So you have essentially no moisture and you have dry ascent through the boundary layer up to about 550 millibars. Looking at that 12 hours later in the Amarillo sounding, and note the westerly low-level flow there transporting that directly east towards Amarillo. What do you notice about the lapse rates in the Amarillo sounding above that shallow moist layer? Anybody, any thoughts? It's essentially the same. So you're taking that the very top of that boundary layer, and you're moving it directly east over Amarillo. So your lapse rates are essentially unchanged. So your largest contribution in the lapse rate tendency at Amarillo is from differential advection because you're moving it from Albuquerque east towards Amarillo. So everything on the right now is the Norman sounding. And you'll notice that the purple underlay is the same as the 12Z Amarillo sounding, but the Norman sounding is now 12 hours later from the Amarillo sounding at 0Z May 4th. So again, here in Norman, we're about, 350 meters above the surface of mean sea level, whereas Amarillo is up closer to around a kilometer. So again, you've taken that direct moisture, the direct same lapse rates, the same potential temperatures within that mixed boundary layer, and you've transported them due east towards Norman. But there's one key difference from the Amarillo and Albuquerque soundings. Anybody spot it? And it's pretty different in the low levels there. Surface moisture, exactly. So not only are you priming the mid-levels for instability by steepening your lapse rates, you know, 9-10 C per kilometer above that, you've also added low-level moisture to the mix. Your surface dew point at Norman is 66 degrees Fahrenheit. So you've added all this moisture underneath a layer of extremely steep mid-level lapse rates, where temperatures fall off very quickly with height, and you've added the potential for latent heat release below that. And so it's no surprise when we think about that, that when you add those two together, you end up with a situation where you can release large amounts of buoyancy through differential advection primarily. And you see that on the right, a large area of positive buoyancy in this QT. So another thing to think about, again, we'll get to vertical wind shear later, is the differential advection automatically sets you up for vertical wind shear because you have low-level moisture return from the south-southeast across, you know, Norman in this case, and you have mostly west-southwesterly flow in the low and mid-levels. So you end up with a profile that is automatically vertically sheared. And this is what we call a classic loaded gun sounding. We call it a loaded gun because there's usually a little bit of a cap, but above that, you have a lot of unrestricted free buoyancy. and you have strong vertical shear that can support the development of tornadic supercells. And that's exactly what happened on this day. I think 66 tornadoes, the Moore F5, and a whole lot of destruction from these tornadoes in Oklahoma. So looking at some of the climatology behind all this, this is a paper by Lenici and Warner from 1991. They looked at essentially the number of days that you develop elevated mixed layers or EMLs over portions of the southern and central plains. And so this figure on the right shows the mean number of days in their sample where you had what they call lid days, or essentially days where you have a cap with a large elevated mixed layer above it. So starting at the top left, that's April, you have about 5. We jump to May, which is around 7 to 8, and then June, which is about 6. And then they do a subtraction too to see the differential in that June minus April. But what they're really looking at is the distribution of maximum potential temperature in the boundary layer. So we'll go to the next figure here in a second, but on average, those temperatures in April are 36 to 40 C, May it's 40 to 44 C, and in June it's 48 to 52 C. So they're monotonically increasing throughout the year as you get increases in solar radiation. Yeah.
I was just wondering if the UTs with the elevated mixed layer, where that cap is, because it looked like there was southwesterly flow across much of the mid-levels, but it looks like there's a very clear boundary where the EML starts. So what determines where that sets up?
Primarily, and we'll get into this in a little bit, it's the strength of the differential advection. So how strong are your southwesterlies and where it's coming from, the time of year, and the types and sources of lift that are impacting that. Because as you go throughout the cycle ahead of a trough, you're actually going to be removing parts of the EML as you're lifting and steepening the boundary layer in the low and mid levels. So does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so here's that plot I was kind of talking about. So you can see on the left there, that's April. So over the Colorado High Plateau, southern New Mexico, and the southern Rockies, you have a large area of 36 to kind of 40 degree potential temperatures. So, and remember, potential temperature is rising the parcel towards saturation and then decreasing it all the way down to 1,000 millibars. And that's your potential temperature. So these are not surface temperatures or anything like that. But this tells us values that can be conserved and that we can advect easily. So continuing to look, it increases again through May. So we're at 40 to kind of 44 C. And then June, we're at 48 to 52 C. So as we go throughout the spring and into early summer, thinking about how warm those temperatures are out west, and remember, we're transporting them east. You guys think that would have any impact on maybe things like convective coverage or the number of storms that you can generate through the afternoon on certain severe weather setups? Thinking about things like cap temperature and the ability to break that cap with types of forcing. So we're playing at some ideas here that I want you guys to think about as we're going through. But another example of large EML, this is a Denver sounding. So from early September or mid-September. So again, very classic. You have a lot of heating over portions of the central Rockies. So Denver is at about 5,000 feet, so about a mile up. And you've got a huge elevated mixed layer. So you're essentially generating warm temperatures at the surface that allow you to mix, in this case, all the way up past 500 millibars. So 5 kilometers, basically, straight up in the atmosphere. And you actually do have a little bit of buoyancy at the top of this profile. So you're actually probably getting a few thunderstorms in Denver or the Eastern High Plains later today, but they're going to be super high base, so upwards of 5 kilometers. But if we look further east, and this is North Platte, about 300 miles to the east, 12 hours later, what do we notice about these two profiles? They're essentially the same above the surface. So you've advected that lapse rate layer further east over portions of North Platte. And I want to talk a bit about, too, if you look at the wind speeds in the boundary or in the top of the EML across North Platte, you can make a pretty good estimate on how fast and where those lapse rates are going to end up. So for reference, Denver is about 300 miles southwest of North Platte. And if you look at the winds out of North Platte on the sounding there, it's on the south-southwest at about 25 miles per hour, so or 25 knots. So if you run that math backwards, 300 divided by 12 is 25. So so you're ending up with that, or 300 divided by 25 is 12, sorry. You're ending up with that same lapse rate advection over that same time period. You can get educated guesses on where that EML will be in certain hours just using observations from numerical or from these soundings. So you don't even have to use numerical weather prediction. You can say, I know this steep lapse rate is here. I know that the mean flow within this layer is X miles per hour. I know in 12 hours that it could be potentially Y miles further east, and you could know what type of lapse rates you're dealing with. And you can do the same thing with moisture, which is what we're going to do next. And then in this case, 12 hours later in Omaha, where you have significant moisture advection in the low levels, again, beneath that EML, you've got strong heating and mixing in the moist sector. Below that, you're generating large positive buoyancy. And this looks very similar to the Norman case where we had large-scale tornadoes. And I believe there were a couple tornadoes today from this sounding as well. So going back to the potential temperature ideas, this is just the average sounding, kind of what it looks like. This is May 19th of 2013. So this is another tornadic supercell case here. If we plot that 36 to kind of 40, I believe this is the midpoint at 38 C. So this is early April, essentially. You notice that we're slightly to the left of where the May profile is. But if we plot the early May profile on there, just from the guess on the climatology of potential temperature, it pretty much lines up exactly with the lapse rates that we see on the Norman sounding. So this actually works in real life, and we use it all the time at SPC to say, hey, okay, we know that it's mid-May. What are we going to expect for our average lapse rate temperature? And then here's June on there. So you're essentially just shifting the profile to the right as you go through summer and late spring. You're just warming the profile up and shifting it to the right. So going back to the idea too that differences in the EML can tell you things about the strength of the cap. If, for instance, you've got temperatures that are warmer than average across New Mexico, Southern Colorado, all that through early May, you may end up with an EML that's stronger than what you expect. And if your EML is stronger, you can make the educated guess of, oh, we may have trouble initiating thunderstorms today unless we have really strong lift because we can't clear the cap. So you can use these observational ideas to inform yourself about what may happen in the future without using any sort of numerical weather prediction. So they go hand in hand, and we use them both here. But you know, things like that, or even if they're cooler than normal too, you can say, okay, well, we don't have very much of a cap, then we can generate too many storms that can interfere with each other. We could generate an MCS more easily as opposed to discrete tornadic supercells. So all of these ideas are interlinked and kind of interplay with each other about the advection of the lapse rates and the EML further east. Okay. So I think we've hammered home elevated mixed layers and lapse rates. Let's shift on towards lift. So being one of the key ingredients, again, we've got a couple of different types of lift, mainly synoptic scale, mesoscale, and storm scale. And really those are differences in the rate at which that lift occurs. So synoptic scale, we're looking for things on the order of 1 to 10 centimeters per second. If you run that out and integrate it over 6 hours, you're really only getting about 2 kilometers of ascent. So I know we asked you this question very first week, is synoptic scale lift enough to directly generate thunderstorms? Is it? I see one head shaking no, exactly. So you cannot physically lift air fast enough using synoptic scale processes to generate convective updrafts. Because of this, you know, in 6 hours, you're only generating 2 kilometers of ascent. So really what synoptic scale lift is doing is it's preconditioning the environment. So we've already invected steep lapse rates in, but now we have large scale synoptic lift over that. So we're stretching those lapse rates and continuing the differential advection process. So you're actually making those lapse rates steeper. You're potentially providing low level differential advection of moisture at the same time. So you're preconditioning the environment to become more favorable for severe storms, but you're not explicitly generating them using synoptic lift. Now, mesoscale lift, on the other hand, you know, we're talking about values around 1 meter per second on the order of hours. So in 1 hour at 1 meter per second, you can generate 3 kilometers of ascent. So you've already in a sixth of the time generated over 150% of the same synoptic lift. And these are things like fronts, dry lines, outflow boundaries, even orographics in some parts of the world. But it takes you on average less than an hour to reach the level of free convection in one of the soundings that we showed using these sorts of mesoscale lift. So this is explicitly the type of lift that we're generating deep convection with. So, and really they're really narrow and they can even be generated by other thunderstorms themselves. And then we have storm scale lift. So these are the actual updrafts and downdrafts within the thunderstorms. They're an order of magnitude higher than mesoscale lift. So this is 10 meters per second. So if you integrate that over 15 minutes, say your updraft is 10 meters per second, you've gone up 9 kilometers. So different scales of lift within different frameworks. So talking about some of the sources of synoptic scale lift. So we're going to be talking about warm advection, isentropic ascent, differential positive vorticity advection. So remember at the base of this trough, as we have jet streaks kicking out, we're going to have differences in the potential vorticity per different layers, and then also associated with jet streaks. So you guys remember the four quadrant jet streak model? You've got ascent in the top left, ascent in the bottom there, so, and then curved jets as well. So those can be sources of large scale synoptic lift. And today is a great example of one of these types of lift, which is warm advection. So here's just a mesoanalysis plot of an event here. Have a large cold front running from Tennessee down through Southwest Texas, which is not too dissimilar from today. Actually, we're getting a ton of rain from mainly synoptic scale processes in and around there. But you see, you know, to the northwest of that front across central Texas, central Oklahoma, we've got cool temperatures, you know, a lot of northerly flow. It's, you know, not particularly interesting looking, but when you go south of the front, you've got a lot of southeasterly flow, essentially perpendicular to that boundary. So you're running into the density current of the front because you've got colder air on the other side, and you're starting to force it up the isentropes on that front. So if you look here at 925, you've got some stronger low-level flow. So we're off the surface, friction is a little bit less, and you've got that same southerly flow, but the magnitudes are a lot higher. And also, you've got a sloped frontal surface. So you're starting to ride up those warm adiabats, and now you've also got an area of large-scale differential temperature advection. So you're increasing your temperature advection in the low and mid-levels here, mainly across like the Rio Grande Valley, little bit into central Texas, kind of have the winds turning a little east with hype. So you're really looking for where they're more southerly right now. And then stepping up even further at 850, again, following that frontal surface, you're higher and even closer. You're now into parts of central and maybe even northwestern Texas. So you're pushing that air up the isentrope as you're conserving the adiabatic properties there, and you're generating precipitation near the warm advection core. So, and actually northwest of the warm advection. So this is a really common way to generate synoptic lift, and you can potentially generate thunderstorms this way as you have mesoscale processes beneath that warm advection that result in convergence and confluence that you can generate thunderstorms with. So again, this is essentially exactly what's happening today, but slightly different. But you'll notice along with that too, that a lot of the isentropic ascent is favored away from areas where you have, in this case, surface-based cape, because your cape is elevated. So you're essentially generating all of that lift and all of the moisture convergence at a higher level in the atmosphere above a stable layer. So this is why a lot of times here, last 2 weeks, for example, why we had thunder sleet and freezing rain potential, because we had that really shallow layer of cold air beneath of it, and we had essentially warm overrunning over top of it, but we're generating a convective boundary layer above the surface stable layer, and you get precipitation that falls through that as winter precip. So I'm glad we're not dealing with that today. That would suck. And then looking at this from a SKU-T perspective, so here's the Corpus Christi sounding. So you notice we've got a lot of veering winds with height, which indicate warm advection. So your winds are turning with height, but you know, you've got a nice warm and moist layer. So 77 over 74, I believe. Yep. And a lot of positive buoyancy that we just saw on mesoanalysis. Now if we go further northwest, so there's that frontal slope. So we've got the big old cutout in the middle there, 53 over 55. So we've gone down essentially 20, 25 degrees at the surface. But above that, the temperatures are almost the exact same as Corpus Christi. You just have a big frontal bite out of the bottom. So the top of your boundary layer is still convective. And again, we have positive buoyancy above that. We just have essentially a low-level inversion that is preventing stuff from being surface-based, but we have most unstable cape aloft. Okay, so kind of a summary of synoptic scale. It's mostly gradual. So you're gonna be dealing with stuff that develops over hours to days. It's warm advection and primarily potential vorticity advection driven. And the primary role is really to precondition the environment. So you're not generating storms explicitly with these types of lift because it's just too slow. So, but you're essentially making the environment more favorable over time that allows thunderstorms to more easily flourish when you have favorable synoptic ascent like this. Okay, mesoscale lift. So remember, these are kind of values around 1 meter per second, kind of below 10 meters per second on that time and on the time scale of hours. So they're focused in narrow zones. We kind of talked about some of the common locations for these. So fronts, frontogenesis, so frontogenical circulations as well. So we talked about warm advection over top of boundary layer surfaces, but when you do that, you're also generating secondary circulations with the frontogenesis. And a lot of times those can be the actual triggers of thunderstorms in warm advection regimes. So as you're generating those rollers and frontal surfaces start to bend around the actual frontogenic circulations. And then synoptic lift. So another one is outflow boundaries. Think of these as density currents, or essentially cold fronts in miniature. So you have the same sort of sloped frontal surfaces that can push lift up very quickly, a couple kilometers, but they aren't usually very deep. And they're generated by other thunderstorms, large rain-cooled air masses. You can technically even generate these using glaciers and snowpack. So if you are in a certain part of the world, you a lot of times have katabatic flow off of a glacier. That will essentially act like a density current or an outflow boundary from glaciers. And then one of the more common ones here is the dry line. So a lot of times you'll have a dry line that'll develop in the western parts of Oklahoma, the Texas Panhandle, and that's a great source of mesoscale lift. You can have values of ascent on there anywhere from a half to 3 meters per second at times. But a lot of that lift is actually on the dry side of the dry line. So we'll go into an explicit example later this year on how to use that. But for now, just think of the dry line as a source of lift and potential trigger for mesoscale type thunderstorms. And we'll look at an example here of So this is May 24th of 2011. This is another large tornado outbreak here. The first El Reno F5, and then a couple tornadoes just southwest of Norman. So visible satellite imagery, this is right afternoon, so 12:40 p.m. You notice you've got a couple bands of cumulus that are starting to show up along potential dry line. We don't have surface atmosphere, but just take my word for it, it's a dry line. You notice a couple hours later, you know, we've had, you know, about an hour and a half to work on that. So remember, in an hour, we can ascend about 3 to 4 kilometers. If our LFC is at about 3.5 in that hour, we can punch that updraft all the way through. We can start utilizing some of that positive buoyancy. And sure enough, we have incipient thunderstorms developing on the dry line there after we have about an hour showing those rising cumulus. So cool things about dry lines, you can use them essentially like clocks. I mean, really, they line up great with the diurnal cycle. And anytime within a 2 to 3 hour window, you can say, I'm pretty confident if there's enough lift on this dry line and the cap is small enough that we are going to have convective initiation along that feature. And sure enough, it works really well. So, oh, there's the surface up. So I should have moved that slide up. But you can see the very classic dry line convergence signature. You've got dew points in the teens across the Texas Panhandle, temperatures in the 80s and 90s. And then on the warm and moist side of the dry line, you've got temperatures in the low to mid 80s and then dew points in the 60s and 70s. So differential difference of dew point there of, you know, 40, 50 degrees in some cases. So we talked about some of the lift on the dry line being on the dry side. And we can see in this case, the same elevated mixed layer type signature that we just talked about. Whoops. So you've got a boundary. This is actually 12Z, so we don't have the full boundary layer developed yet. We've got the surface inversion, but if you ignore that surface inversion, you can make a good estimate for how deep the atmosphere in the PBL, the planetary boundary layer, will mix across parts of Amarillo behind the dry line that day. So a lot of south-southwesterly flow, so you're essentially downslope warming across Amarillo as you go down the terrain. You're heating things up with the sun, and you can say that the temperatures at Amarillo later today are probably going to be about 35, let me see. I guess it's cut off right at the air at the bottom there. But essentially right at the bottom of that mixed layer, because you're warming that up to the potential temperature in and around there. Yeah.
Sorry if I missed this. This is behind the dry line.
This is behind the dry line. This is to the west. Yep. So you're warming the surface layer up as you go through the day, and you're mixing the boundary layer again. You've got a trough to the west, so you're steepening the lapse rates. You're potentially mixing all the way up above 500 millibars. So you've got essentially 5 kilometers of ascent on the dry side of the dry line. So, and there's a large circulation that kind of goes like this. So when you overlay that, oh, I should mention the arrow is kind of mentioning the potential ascent that you have on the dry side of the dry line. So now if you overlay that on the other side, the warm or the moist side of the dry line, we got a couple key differences. So we have the advection of the warm, moist air with our southeasterly winds across parts of Oklahoma. We have a much smaller boundary layer. Looking at that, it's only, you know, it's 1200 meters essentially. So you have a 1200 meter boundary layer compared to a 3 to 4 kilometer boundary layer. And notice the arrow on the side here. So that is the potential depth of the lift that you have on the dry side of the dry line compared to that on the moist side. And what do you notice about the depth of the lift above the on the Norman sounding here? So pay special attention to that little three-letter yellow acronym, the LFC. So essentially, the lift on the dry side of the dry line is past the level of free convection on the moist side by about half. So you're essentially punching through the cap with the dry line, you know, ascent of 1 to 2 meters per second over a couple of hours. There is no cap on the dry side. It's lifting parcels up, and as they had obtained the moisture from the moist side, you're moving past the level of free convection where you have no sin anymore. So you're essentially forcing ascent on the dry side of the dry line to generate updrafts that then utilize the buoyancy on the moist side. So this is a fantastic way to get thunderstorms, and you can compare the two there and see that, you know, if, for instance, you didn't have a dry line, the maximum, you know, boundary layer lift that you could generate would be below that cap and you wouldn't generate convection. So the convergence and the frontal circulation on the dry line is really key to generating thunderstorms here in the spring and summer. And this just goes to show that, you know, you have that large differential in lift. Yeah.
So if they confuse somehow the dry side interacts with the moist side, if there's a boundary there, how does the dry side influence the lift on the moist side?
You have a frontal circulation. So
here, let me, do you have a marker? Or, I don't know if I do.
They always do.
All right, let me go back here. So the boundary is not a solid wall. So you have, think of this kind of like an isentropic surface too on a front. So at the surface, you have a difference, but that frontal surface slopes. So you have warm, moist air overriding the dry part further up in the atmosphere. So you have ascent on the dry side, but you have moisture coming at it from the east too. Does that kind of make sense?
It's approaching the boundary from the east.
Yes.
Where it can interact with that really deep mixed layer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And so you have, essentially, you're overrunning the dry side of the dry line aloft, and you're generating lift on that dry side that can essentially lift that moisture. It's not as moist as the surface layer on the moist side, but you're still lifting moisture. Does that kind of make more sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing? Okay.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah. And we'll show it a bit like this too. So here's your surface. I always bring pens. Sorry, guys. I need more. But here's your dry line surface. So we'll just do it. And so we'll say this is the moist side, this is the dry side. So your frontal surface is sloped like this. You have your deep mixing in your planetary boundary layer that's generating this, but you have moisture that's actually kind of like this. So we'll just say moisture. So while you're generating your updrafts on your dry side, there's really crappy cloud, you know, and this is the surface, and this is somewhere.
You're actually overrunning that moisture over top of it and generating the convective updrafts on the other side. And then as they move off, you know, they're much lower and they're utilizing that moisture better. Does that make more sense, Ethan?
I think so.
Okay. We'll give more explicit ideas and examples of dry lines in the future. So I think we have a whole class talking about dry lines and that sort of thing. But you essentially have a circulation that develops, and you have ascent. And you can explain this all with frontogenesis, actually, if you guys have had that in mesoscale. But the ascent on the dry line is actually on the dry side. So you actually generate your updrafts over there as opposed to the moist side. All right, so where were we? You're kind of there. But that dry ascent on the other side can tell you if you're going to be able to generate convection on the dry line that day just by comparing the two soundings. So if you know, okay, my boundary layer at Amarillo is way deeper than Norman, and the mixing looks really strong, I have a good idea, you know, above the level of free convection at Norman that I can generate potential thunderstorms. Yeah.
So in this instance, some level 925, is that kind of what we're getting at?
Yeah, 850, 925. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the level of free convection here is about 700 millibars. The Norman boundary layer is capped around 850, and then the Amarillo level or of ascent goes all the way up to about 600 millibars. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Can you explain again how like the magnitude of that arrow that you have?
Sure. So that is essentially the top of the boundary or the depth of the boundary layer in the mixing in the Amarillo sounding. So
in this case, this is our skew T. It's 12Z. So it's early morning. We haven't had the sun come up and all that at Amarillo. So by, you know, afternoon, we'll say 21Z. You've heated that atmosphere up and you've gotten rid of the surface inversion here. Have a temperature of, we'll say, 32 Celsius as opposed to what, 55 Fahrenheit or whatever it is. So we'll say 90 Fahrenheit over here. So you warm that atmosphere up. So that magnitude of that arrow is the depth of the mixed layer. Does that make sense? We're not actually quantifying the type of lift or the amount in there, but you have the boundary layer circulation that develops in there is just essentially the depth of that mixed layer. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
So here, the top of the arrow is indicating that it tends to be like the top.
Yeah.
So I understand when we do like the basic of what you're kind of like the schematic you're trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine that there's a possibility that there could still be a cap on the other side or like on the voice side, like in the settings that you had pulled up.
Yeah.
So how would you know how much cap is too much cap that as soon as those storms move onto the moist side it just will fill up?
That is a really great question. Mostly experience. And I should clarify, this is not some like explicit quantitative information. This is not like if the mixed layer is 500 millibars, we're absolutely going to get thunderstorms. I'm sorry, guys. I should have clarified that. This is just a rough approximation. This is kind of an idea. When you see that these features are like this, you should think like, okay, we've got deep ascent. We have the potential to generate convection on the dry line. Does that make more sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm assuming that like there's a point where it's like you can have this, and even if your voice set is capped, you can still have an updraft strong enough to persist the storm into the voice sector.
Yes.
And I'm assuming there's some sort of like imaginary boundary where the cap will just kill it as soon as it transitions over. So I was wondering what you would think about that.
Yeah. A lot of times it's just experience and knowing what values are too high. Usually if I wake up in the morning and I see mixed layer convective inhibition greater than 400 or 500 joules per kilogram, it doesn't matter how strong the dry line is unless you have a monster trough that's kicking out and you have just tons and tons of synoptic lift, you're just not going to be able to generate enough lift to punch through the cap and get storms. Is that kind of more what you're getting at? Is Yeah, there's not really hard or fast rules, which is why convection allowing models struggle with this, because minute differences in the temperature, a couple degrees C at one layer, can mean the difference between zero inhibition after deep mixing and several hundred. So am I right on that?
Yeah, so that's the point of the right hot input and operating something like that.
Yeah. And this is why different mixing schemes in certain convection allowing models always generate convection on the dry line if they're too dry and too warm, because they say, okay, the dry line circulation is way stronger as opposed to certain instances where other models with less favorable boundary layer schemes who are more cool and moist, they say there's never convection on the dry line because, you know, the cap's too strong, it doesn't matter. So, but all of this plays also in with the synoptic ascent that is occurring ahead of troughs and other things that are kicking out because you're preconditioning that cap by partially removing it by lifting over a couple hours ahead of when you have that deep mixing too. So there's not really a hard and fast rule on how to do it. But when you start looking at the values and start getting experience by saying, okay, I know I have deep mesoscale lift for several hours. I know I have strong synoptic lift for a day or two prior. I might be getting into the territory where I could break that cap. Does that make sense? Okay. There's a reason why there's a whole field studying mesoscale and all the fun stuff here with dry lines and PPL schemes and all that is because there's still a lot we don't know about how all this. So this is really just a conceptual model of kind of how to understand the types of mesoscale lifting on the dry line and that certain situations lend more magnitude towards that. So great questions today, guys. So if I'm confusing you anywhere else, please don't be hesitant to shout it out because this is really important toward the forecasting stuff later. Okay. So, and then we're just overlaying it. And so you see the difference in the boundary layer mixing depth that I was getting at with these two figures. And then here's an animation of the dry line, and you see the thunderstorms firing off, had stuff all the way, develop all the way down into North Texas. Okay, so summary on mesoscale lift in the dry line. It's basically focused ascent around a meter per second over the course of a couple hours. We'll get into residence time of convective boundaries and the dry line later and why that's important. Because if you have more time to lift a parcel, you're going to obviously lift it deeper with a meter per second updraft. And usually that convection is more isolated because of the type of lift that's occurring. Cold fronts produce much more broad area of lifting as opposed to dry lines. Okay, so now we're going to talk about moisture and a bit of the return flow cycle. Moisture, we obviously need that in the boundary layer to generate deep convection. It has to come from somewhere, mainly the Gulf of Mexico. A couple different processes can affect that. So inland vertical mixing, you've heard the clash of air masses before. So moisture takes a lot longer to return if you have a dry air mass. And then even evapotranspiration. If you've heard the term corn dew points in parts of Iowa and the upper Midwest, that's mostly from evapotranspiration. So, but a key element of return flow is that you basically have to modify air over warm water, and it takes several days to happen. So that's why after a big cold front goes through the Gulf of Mexico, there's usually not severe weather for a couple days after because you've essentially removed the moisture source. So you need to ask yourself a couple questions. Where is the air coming from in this case? What are the underlying ocean characteristics and what are the characteristics of the return flow? Is it quality low-level moisture or is it kind of scattershot? So here's a couple graphs showing just Gulf of Mexico mean sea surface temperatures. And so water has a large specific heat capacity, so it can hold on to heat a lot better than air or land surfaces. And so you see that the minimum in Gulf sea surface temperatures is actually at the end of winter. It's essentially now, late February through early March is when the Gulf waters are the coolest that they normally are. And then as we go back in through spring and summer and fall, the direct solar heating heats up the Gulf and you get return of the warm values. But you see the variations per year in the Gulf of Mexico and all those temperatures. But really, it's very consistent. But any year between, there's usually only 1 to 2 C degree differences in your temperatures. So it's a very consistent body of water. And we can use that to our advantage because if we know things like the residence time and the properties of the air moving over that water, we can actually make educated guesses about the potential dew points based on nothing but the sea surface temperatures. So water temperatures in the low to mid 70s can generate, you know, temperatures, potential dew points, 18, 19, 20, 23 C. And it really depends on where in the Gulf you're having that air be modified over. So further south in the Caribbean Sea, west of Cuba there, warmer water temperatures in the 80s can generate dew points in the 70s. So here's classic frontal intrusion case. So you've got the cloud band there and the cold front marked. You've got your moisture ahead of it, but behind it, you've got a much colder air mass that you're moving out of the continental US. So differential in temperature between the water and the ocean surface, about 15 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is day one. So, and notice you've got northerly return flow or northerly flow, basically offshore. So you have no modification of the air mass at first. But now we're on day two. Notice the winds have shifted a little bit. We're more out of the east, northeast. We've still got a big temperature difference in the water and the air. Still around 10 degrees Fahrenheit, but that's gone up 5 degrees in about 12 hours, 24 hours. So you're already starting to modify that air mass as you're losing the frontal characteristics. So your front's getting washed out because the atmosphere, again, doesn't like big gradients. So it's trying to make the air mass more uniform. And so that's causing the front to weaken and the air mass behind it to modify. And you can actually see this in satellite too. You see the patterns in the clouds there. So that's cellular convection over the ocean. You have the diabatic heat source that's causing large circulations that are developing clouds there. And so you have areas of ascent and areas of descent, and you're mixing that warmer, moist air closer to the surface up into the air mass with time. And so you're actually modifying it. And then now on to day three, you know, you've had essentially 72 hours to kind of modify that air. You're starting to get southerly winds returning in across parts of the Texas coast. And you see that the dew point is starting to rise there. So we've only got about a 5 degree difference between the air temperature and water temperature now. And you're starting to move that air mass back on land with time. Looking at this from a sounding perspective, here's Brownsville, Texas. So right at the coast of where you had that offshore flow. First day, not too much different. You've had the front go through, you've got northerly winds. Dew point's pretty low, 44 degrees. Temperature, still 62, a lot nicer than here. But you're still cold, you're dry, you're not really modifying. Now on to day two, you've kind of got that easterly flow. You've had a little bit of chance for the warm air over the Gulf of Mexico to work on the air that's now moving on shore from the east. And so your temperatures and dew points have gone up. You're now in the mid 50s and temperatures almost 70. So, and now here's day three. So now you've got that southerly flow starting to return back. You've had 72 hours to modify the air mass, and you've got temperatures in the mid 70s and dew points around mid 60s. So that multi-day process is what it takes as you're trying to establish equilibrium of the air mass with the water temperature in the Gulf. And then essentially now you've just got undiluted tropical air starting to flow north into Brownsville. Temperatures in the mid-70s, dew points in the 70s too. So now you're right back to that tropical air mass that was ahead of the front in the first place. Okay. So now that we've got moisture kind of moving back up, what's it going to do when it starts to interact with vertical mixing and warmer temperatures and drier air masses on the continental US? So we can actually have moisture that decreases during the day, and that's primarily due to vertical mixing. So things like the quality of your moisture and how deep it is in the boundary layer can tell you a lot about what the moisture is going to do. So here's a surface map, Southern Plains. So we've got 60 degree dew point, 64 is quite a bit splotchier. And we don't really have, a big deep slug of air, moist air coming up. It's kind of splotchy. It's not super coherent. And if we look aloft at 850, we can see that same sort of thing. We've got a few dew points that are a bit higher, kind of along the portion of that low-level jet, but we don't really have a big, good, concentrated area of deeper moisture. So that tells us that the moisture is pretty shallow. And if we look at the visible satellite, we've got a lot of sun right now. Not a lot of cloud cover until we get up into like parts of eastern Nebraska. So we're probably going to have good deep mixing throughout the afternoon. If we know that the air mass with moisture is shallow and we're going to be mixing that, we probably are starting to think that, oh, we might have some problems retaining those higher dew points later in the day. Yeah. And then we could also look at things like soil moisture too. This is kind of more of a secondary effect, but if you've had a lot of drought and the plants aren't doing super well, they can start to suck moisture out of the air, kind of the reverse of evapotranspiration. But here's the 12Z Norman sounding. So this is 6 a.m. when we have our 60, 64 degree dew points. If we mix that through the afternoon, you know, we've warmed up, we've got surface temperatures around 80. Our dew point goes from 65 to 58. So, and you can see how shallow that moisture layer depth is on the 12Z sounding. So it's less than half a kilometer. So as you go through that time frame, you're essentially distributing that over the depth of the mix layer. If you take that value and it has to stay constant because we aren't injecting a lot more, you have to now spread it over a thicker layer. It has to decrease. So we can see the same thing at Lamont, which is just a couple 100 miles north of Oklahoma City, 61 degree dew points down to 56. But that's a different story up at Omaha. So remember, we had that cloud band up there. We're not going to be mixing as much because we have deeper clouds, and it's going to take time for those clouds to burn off. And also, we have deeper moisture up top. So the mixed layer depth of the boundary layer moisture there is around a kilometer. So as opposed to half a kilometer, now we've got a kilometer depth deep layer of moisture that actually increases with height because we've got some pooling along the front. It's cooler. We've got clouds. We can actually generate or retain that deeper moisture. So we actually raise our surface dew point through vertical mixing at the surface. So we go from 52 at 12Z to 66 at 0Z. And there were actually several tornadoes this day in portions of central Iowa. So vertical mixing can be both good and bad for vertical or moisture. It just depends on where you're getting it from, how deep your mixing is, and what the quality is at that certain time. So this is where soundings are really useful for assessing that type of thing. So does that all make sense, kind of how that situation played out? Okay. Evapotranspiration, we're gonna go through this pretty quickly. So a couple of things that you need for these really high dew points. You see these a lot of times in Iowa, Illinois, during the summer when you have a mature corn crop or wheat. You can even get it here in Oklahoma with winter wheat in September, October. But if you've got plentiful rain, mature crops, and a capped boundary layer to kind of trap that moisture, sometimes you can see a lot of increase in the surface dew point. But a lot of that background is almost always significant return flow. So you've had several days of warm, moist air kind of come up, but then that the plants help add to that with time. So here's an example. We're looking at Iowa, Minnesota. There's not a lot of drought. Plants are probably doing pretty well. We've got southerly flow. So these dew points, 68 to 72. The yellow is 72 plus. So you've got southerly winds. So last couple of days, you've been transporting that warm, moist air in. But as you go through the day, you start mixing. You allow those plants to open their pores and start spreading out more humidity. You end up with dew points that are above 76, 78 C. So, but they're only really a small contribution to that. So, and if you look here on the Davenport sounding, you know, you've got already got a significantly depth significantly deep moist layer that you have, you know, dew points of 69 degrees with a mixed layer depth around a kilometer, kilometer and a half. So as you go through the day, you're mixing. And the telltale sign with evapotranspiration dew points is this skin layer, or what we call, so that little kind of tag that sticks out from the dew point, where it's, if you looked at that value, that'd probably be closer to 71, 72, where the surface value is actually 70, 75. So a lot of that moisture from plants and evapotranspiration from the ground is very shallow, but it can impact things like surface-based cape calculations. So because if your surface-based dew point is 75, you know, it's using that to say you have 6,000 to 7,000 joules per kilogram of surface-based cape. Whereas if you had used the mixed layer, which kind of averages over that depth, your boundary layer dew point may actually only be, you know, 71 to 70. So you can actually end up with significant differences in that. And then here's another example from LIX, but yeah, you generate a lot of positive buoyancy at the surface with these types of dew points, but it can be misleading. Okay, so we talked a bit about the dry line and some of that. So we're going to talk about some lee cyclogenesis and its impacts on return flow and lapse rates. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just kind of going with that a
little bit. Yeah.
Can you show the route map that I'm thinking about something? You guys look into like kind of this route trends in terms of, I was thinking, for example, if you have a lot of drought in like the high plains, like Mexico and stuff, you're going to have more central heat flux dominating, so it's going to warm the boundary layer a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. Does that translate to like a warmer elevated mixed layer that leads to like a less robust severe weather season?
Absolutely. Yes, that plays a huge role. So we're always looking at drought trends, and you've hit the nail on the head exactly. So that larger sensible heat flux and greater surface heating can lead to EMLs that are stronger over parts of the southern plains or things like that, that can really suppress severe weather. That's part of the reason why we haven't had as much over the last 3 years. We've been in La Nina type conditions, which favor drought over that corner of the country. And so we end up with situations where caps are stronger. We're not necessarily generating the same types of convection or the amounts of convection over that time frame, which actually a bit of a positive feedback for drought conditions if you get that. But yeah, that is an excellent point, and we do look at that. So great question. Okay. So lee cyclogenesis, we've all kind of heard the term. So in the development or the lee of Rocky Mountains or mountain ranges, we a lot of times see the development of a cyclone or a trough. A couple different factors kind of go into that. We have subsidence warming, so that's warm air going over top of the mountains and being compressed adiabatically as it decreases. And so you can generate essentially a warm core low at the surface there, where you're spreading the isobars with increased thickness in the mid-levels. You can also generate frontal type or frontogenic circulation, so through katabatic flows. So heating of surfaces through stronger sensible heat flux can generate lift and upslope flow, which results in sort of a circulation that develops along the terrain. So you can actually lower the pressure that way too. You see this a lot of times at its strongest when you have flow that's perpendicular to the mountain range. And that's convenient for us because the Rocky Mountains are essentially a north to southwest or a north to south mountain range, and our flow is predominantly westerly. So a lot of times we have flow that's perpendicular to the range. That generates that subsidence warming ahead of even the best arrival of, you know, QG processes. So you can do this without a strong trough and a strong ascent. You can essentially still generate surface lee lows. Here again is a terrain map, and you've got the prevailing wind that lines up perpendicularly with the, you know, Rocky Mountains, and you get downslope flow and all that type of warming as it moves on to the lower plains. To a lesser extent, you can actually get this over the Appalachians too. Is anyone here from the Mid-Atlantic? Okay, yeah. So you can get lee or weak lee cyclones in places like Southwest Virginia, Northern Maryland, all that. So it's not as common. Obviously, they're not as tall and the effect is somewhat muted, but you can see it, and we do get it. So here is a case from Yes, May 4th, 2007. So this is the Greensburg tornado. This is ahead of that. So you notice the main trough is lagging pretty far west. We're up over, you know, portions of the Pacific Northwest, the Intermountain West, but we've got strong southwesterly flow over top of the Rockies. So we're generating that downslope on the other side. And with time, you know, we've still got that southwesterly flow. You can actually generate a lee low well ahead of where the QG processes would tell you. So thinking back to our QG example of where our height falls and all that are, it would tell you the low is much more likely to be over parts of like Arizona and southwestern New Mexico and all that. But if you look at the surface map, we do have semblances of low. So that's the QG influence. But we've also got the mesoscale impacts from the mountain range, the warming of that. We have a lee low that develops right there. And that's a very favored position for that development. And with time, that lee low will strengthen as we start to get large scale influence moving out over it. And you actually can, you know, thinking back to our advection. So if you've got a stronger pressure gradient, you've got stronger southeasterly winds, with time, with that lee low, you're essentially going to be helping that differential advection. You're going to say, I want to pull that Gulf moisture up faster if I have a lee low and a stronger surface low than if you didn't have one. So you can also look at this in a potential vorticity framework. So I promise this is like the last time I'll show an equation. We'll let Ming handle all that. But with a couple, you can make a couple of assumptions about an atmosphere. And with that, we can assume that potential vorticity is conserved. So a couple of assumptions, constant density, and incompressibility, and also stability. So frictionless and adiabatic, you can actually assume that potential vorticity is conserved. So here's our lovely mountain range. If you have westerly flow moving over that mountain range, your adiabats will tend to follow that terrain at times. And so you end up with areas where you're compressing the column, areas where you're increasing the depth of the column. And if you look at the potential vorticity equation, which is a conserved quantity, if our DZ changes over that, we have to have some aspect of the numerator change as well. So with F being planetary vorticity, that doesn't change very much. The planet's not, you know, speeding up and slowing down. So the only other thing that can change is the value of the relative vorticity with respect to the theta surfaces. And the primary method at which that changes is vertical stretching. So it's the exact same thing as taking the figure skater where you've got arms out where they're spinning slowly and arms in, they're spinning faster. So you're essentially conserving that potential vorticity by increasing the depth of the column. You're stretching that vorticity, which causes it to intensify. And so that you can also talk about lee cyclogenesis in that framework. So we know now that we have an area of lower pressure because we've warmed the column. We've got downsloping, we've got a potential, you know, frontal type circulation, and now we're introducing positive vorticity over that area of lower pressure. You've got all that, and you can start to say, oh, I've got a surface low that's developing right there. So, and another thing is that that stretching also lowers the static stability too. So on top of that, you're further increasing your potential favoring severe weather using just that the development of that lee low and all that. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that you can do with this. If you were to look at this from a top-down perspective too, you know, where you're going over the mountains, your column is shrinking, right? So if you've got flow like this, you're actually going to introduce anticyclonic flow up over the mountains before you then introduce the cyclonic part of vorticity. And then you end up with a lee trough right there. So you can talk about lee troughing and its aspects through QG. You can talk about it through adiabatic processes, but you can explain it with a lot of different things. And all those factors contribute to the development of lee troughing and lee cyclogenesis on the lee side of mountains. Okay. So final thing, we'll go over some of the nocturnal low-level jet stuff. So I've kind of primed you on everything that we've talked about. So we're now talking, you know, we've got an idea of elevated mixed layer differential advection. We've got moisture return. We've got Lee cyclogenesis, and we've got our sources of lift. So now we've got the low level jet. So a lot of times when we have Lee cyclogenesis, you'll also have strong low level jet response. And that can even develop ahead of a trough too. So without significant synoptic forcing, just like the Lee cyclone. And it's primarily related to a couple things. So boundary layer decoupling and essentially the loss of friction above that surface, and then diurnal variations in temperature over slope terrain. So, and part of this can actually help raise CAPE values overnight. So after the sun sets, you know, between 0 and 0.3 Z, a lot of times in the plains, you can actually see an increase in buoyancy, an increase in vertical shear with the low level jet. And that can actually cause tornadoes to develop overnight. So a bit about the formation of low-level jets. It's primarily related to the difference in terrain height and heat fluxes. So areas across the western U.S. cool off a lot faster because of their difference in sensible heat flux. And so when you have a difference in vertical thickness between those layers, you actually generate a horizontal pressure gradient that flows from east to west in the low levels. But with Coriolis turning, you take that pressure gradient force, and you turn it 90 degrees towards the north. And so you end up with a north-south area of stronger low-level flow kind of near the terrain. And you can see that on the diagram here. So notice you got the sloped pressure surface, but a constant geopotential surface. You have a pressure gradient that goes in between there. And then this is meant to represent kind of the decoupling boundary layer. So you don't have as much surface friction above that, and you can generate much stronger winds there. And you can see an example here of that. The stronger low-level flow starts to invect that moisture northward overnight, and you can set the stage for stronger low-level wind shear, better moisture response, and the development of instability even after dark. So, and then on top of that, you know, Lee cyclones that we just talked about, they're also aiding in strengthening the pressure gradient. So if you've got a deeper Lee cyclone, say, you know, 1,000 millibars, you're going to be adding to that pressure gradient that is already there because of the terrain. And now you're going to have essentially a cyclone-enhanced low-level jet. And this is super common in late spring and early summer here, where you have you know, not necessarily a strong synoptic system, but you've got westerly flow over the Rockies helping to develop a Lee low. And you can have a 40 to 50 knot low-level jet that develops every night, you know, just a kilometer or two above the surface. And so that obviously plays into an important role if you have storms, because that's helping to increase your hodograph size in the low levels. You're adding to that 1 kilometer shear. And if here's a study by Thompson et al., basically showing the strength of the low-level jet in meters per second with significant tornado events and non-tornadic events too. So you see that there's a pretty significant difference when you have a stronger low-level jet. These are composite cases. So all the EF2 plus tornadoes had much stronger low-level jets. Okay, so quick summary. Lee cyclogenesis can occur when upper-level flow is kind of perpendicular to our terrain features, our Rocky Mountains. Can also occur in places like the Appalachians. There, believe it or not, there's a low-level jet that develops on the lee side of the Appalachians, but it's much weaker. So it's when Lee cyclogenesis is more robust, again, we have lower static stability. And that goes back to that potential vorticity framework where you have stretching of the vertical column. So Lee cyclones help drive low-level moisture because they're help sucking that Gulf moisture up further. So that aids in differential advection, again, preconditioning the environment. And then nocturnal low-level jets associated with Lee cyclones, they're driven by thermal wind balance, horizontal pressure gradients. They can actually increase CAPE and shear overnight at times when you would think, hey, this doesn't make sense. Why is this happening? It's because we have a whole bunch of factors that are helping to increase our low-level moisture and increase our buoyancy and shear at the same time. So that's all I've got. That was a lot. How are we feeling? Good? Okay, I see one thumbs up. Did we learn something? Yeah? Okay. Learn something cool? Yeah. Okay. All right. Any questions? No? Okay.
Yes, I would have to
it's all fine. Hey.